Okay, good morning, everyone. Good morning. Welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. We are one of many, and we noticed one we never noticed before. Where is it? Guadalajara. We never noticed that one. I think that's a new one. Yeah, there's one in Guadalajara, Mexico, in Mexico City. So we're one of over two dozen lodges around the world. And we are devoted to spreading broadcast the teachings of Theosophy. And we do this through two meetings a week. We have one today, of course, and it's the umbrella topic for the month is Masterworks of Modern Theosophy. And we've already done Isis Unveiled and the Secret Doctrine. We'll be discussing the Key to Theosophy today. And next week, we'll be discussing the Voice of the Silence. And on Wednesday nights, from 7:45 to 9 p.m., we have a study class in the Ocean of Theosophy by William Q. Judge, which is a synthesis of the Secret Doctrine. Now, on Wednesday evenings, the doors open at 5:30, and from 5:30 to 7:30, you can avail yourselves of our library right there as you come in to your right. And, you know, we have straight-line theosophical books, which are pretty much all online now, you know. But we have many other books, too, that are on various subjects. Religion, philosophy, science, you know, comparative, you can do comparative religious studies if you like. And so the library closes at 7:30, and then we have a book table in by the fireplace, and that's open before and after the meetings where we sell straight line theosophical literature. Also, if you can make all our efforts here are voluntary donations of time, money, and service. And so if you want to make a monetary contribution, you can do so at the book table, or there's a box on the bookcases where all the pamphlets are on the right as you walk out the door, if you want to be anonymous. Don't worry, we don't publish any lists or anything of donations. So we are an association of students here, and that is our bond. We have similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching. We are not an organization, but we are organized. We have, as you see, you know, we have a format, we have a schedule, we keep to that schedule. We're here to spread broadcast the teachings and to emphasize the fact that universal brotherhood is a fact in nature, that everything is connected, it's all very organic. And so we don't make any distinctions as to race, class, creed, sex, you know, whatever, condition. Yeah, this was written over 100 years ago, and they even put condition in there. So I think that was that pretty much covers everything. Yeah, I'm referring to the Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists here. So, again, it's independent devotion to Theosophy, and we try to exemplify and practice those principles through a truer realization of the self and a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. The true Theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, but to each and all. Now, the topic today is what is the key in the Key to Theosophy, and there'll be two presentations. One, the first one, which I'll be doing, is basically on the preface of the key, which is, and a little bit of background. Now, the key to theosophy is quite literally that. It's a key to unlock the door to deeper study. It is not an exhaustive or complete textbook of on theosophy. It is also not metaphysical. It's very practical, straightforward. There's plenty of other metaphysical books, but this is a good foundation of the basic principles. So it is meant to disseminate the fundamental principles of the timeless wisdom religion. Theosophy is known as the wisdom religion, and we often say ancient, and it is ancient, but it's also timeless. It always existed, and it always will exist. No matter how, sometimes it's hidden, and sometimes it's in the open. And we're fortunate now, since 1875, that these ideas have been seeded, and they've influenced many people. Actually, the most famous person would be Mahatma Gandhi, or Mohandas Gandhi. And he studied in London in 1889, the year the book was written. He was attracted to the Theosophical Society there. He met two brothers, and he was studying the key. And then these two brothers invited him to read the Bhagavad Gita. And he not only had never read it, but they were reading it in Sanskrit, actually. So he never read it in Sanskrit or his native tongue or English or any rendition of it. And he was rather embarrassed of the fact, but he did join them. And he went on to formulate his satyagraha, which is truth force or soul force, which is, it's like the passive resistance is called ahimsa, but it's actually beyond, it's actually an active passive resistance, if that makes any sense. And so he came up with his philosophy after being influenced by theosophy. He did join the society, and then he went to South Africa and on to India. And of course, he changed the whole world, really, and but especially India. And he influenced Martin Luther King, was a very, very much a influenced by Gandhi. So there's an interesting aside is that Gandhi was studying law, and his law professor was interviewed, and he said he was much more interested in fashion than he was the law. So it's really kind of difficult to imagine that Gandhi at one time was completely westernized, was very much into fashion, and thought that the missionaries had convinced him that his Hindu religion was a bunch of superstition. But through theosophy, he got back into it, got into it really for the first time. So, let's see. So in the book, we just it touches on many subjects, and it's in 14 sections. There are both the theoretical and practical aspects of the philosophy, including asceticism, marriage, and education. And it also suggests methods for practical implementation of charity as embodied in Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. It is a synthesis of Eastern and Western philosophy, exploring both ancient and then current thought and thinkers. The key is a key to deeper studies of such works as Isis Unveiled and The Secret Doctrine. Few technical terms of Sanskrit are used. When used to explain ideas, the words that are employed are done in the most lucid way and within the context of the sentence and discussion. In reality, for the reality is that these are seed ideas being introduced into a language and people who have eaten a diet of dogmas and dead letter fodder. Although written to reach the masses, she, H.P. Blavatsky, states, and this is one of her most famous quotes, "To the mentally lazy or obtuse, theosophy must remain a riddle. For in the world mental, as in the world spiritual, each man must progress by his own efforts." So the purpose of the key is to spread broadcast the philosophy of theosophy, which is divine wisdom, power, and knowledge. It helps to disabuse us of the belittling concepts that we are weak, defective, and miserable creatures, and by extension, not really able to help ourselves. H.P. Blavatsky states further that the writer cannot do the reader's thinking for him, nor would he be any better off if such vicarious thought were possible. The book is like Shiva in a way, using Shiva as a metaphor. It destroys old forms in order to create anew. It helps us to plot a plan of action and can be a conduit for change through self-induced and self-devised methods. The key to theosophy opens our soul nature to act on inclinations which have lain dormant. The preface also points out that HPB suffered the wrath of the spiritualists by trying to show them the true nature of their phenomena. Both the facts and fiction of spiritualism is covered in detail in the book. Suffice it to say, in this brief talk, there is nothing spiritual about spiritualism, which is really ignorant dabbling in necromancy. There is no philosophy that has evolved by the random ramblings of disincarnate entities, many of whom are the astral shells of the dregs of society. She says, and this is another quote, the spiritualists, like too many others, preferring to believe what is pleasant rather than what is true, and becoming very angry with anyone who destroys an agreeable delusion, end of quote. And therein lies the key to the animosity and attacks on her person and on theosophy in general. When cherished beliefs are challenged, especially those of an emotional nature, not backed by logic or reason, people feel threatened. They are threatened by the gaping abyss of shattered illusions, but this is the unseen path that the seeker must take. It is a step precarious, that is true, but a necessary step for the thinker, the searcher, and the iconoclast to take.
And there we have a good overview of the preface and why the book was written, and actually a bit of a peek at the contents of the book itself. If we were to travel back to the world of 1889 or 1890, we would be in a very different United States, wouldn't we? If we could picture a time when there was a tremendous surge of immigration and a great deal of conflict among the masses between the nativist, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant population and all of these Southern and Eastern Europeans, the development of large cities, the great changes of a group of people coming out of slavery for the first time, be it in this country or from Russia in particular, the closing of the frontier. There was all this swirling, industrialization, and the rise of the United States as an imperialist power. And in the midst of all that came two wonderful books, Isis Unveiled and The Secret Doctrine, each dedicated to a particular portion of the population and offering a glimpse into this font of wisdom, as was earlier spoken, that had come through the centuries and was preserved in a certain way in Asia and the Middle East. And so we can only imagine the response to the book among the spiritualists in particular, as was just mentioned, but equally among scientists who at that point were very materialistic, among churchianity, folks of a variety of religious experiences, not Asiatic in general, among editors and scholars and academicians of all kinds who were trying to figure out what the documentation for these books were. And stepping into this, if we look into some of the history books, you can come into the library at any time and check out the history of the Theosophical movement from a variety of different sources, and see that this particular, it's called the Little Book. It's a compilation of materials that were left when Isis and The Secret Doctrine were published, that then HPB, in these closing years of her life, on top of all this hubbub and the response and the negativity, HPB was suffering greatly and in 4 years' time would be gone from the planet. So she knew that there was one last opportunity to clarify. And in an article that she wrote called Force of Prejudice, she had this to say: Theosophy is monistic through and through. It seeks one truth in all religions, in all science, in all experience, as in every system of thought. What aim could be nobler, more universal, more all-embracing? It is the hope of weeding these minds from all misconceptions and making the position of theosophy plainer and clearer, gathered all the errors and objections to the theosophy and to its teaching. And therefore, here's the key to the door to more intense study. In essence, what she was doing was compiling an insurance policy as well as a pure porthole to the philosophy, so that what happened with the Darwinian theory, with the Spencer making it popularized and twisting and turning it, that there would remain behind a very plain, very clear exposition of the door of theosophy. And that door is knowledge. The entire underpinning of this collection of dialogue is that knowledge is the key to all human progress and to all happiness, and that if each of us strives to find that knowledge within and to produce it as we live, the world would be far better. The book is written in a dialogue form, and she'd used that technique before in a couple of articles, but we're also reminded in this little textbook of the Gita in a certain way, because the dialogue is actually, the inquirer is a soul that has reached a particular stage of intelligence and open-minded search. And the inquirer is soul speaking to the higher, asking for clarification, but is ready to hear the exchange and is open and ready and able to take in a serious, concise explanation of truth. There's a couple of different ways you can come to study the key. You can abuse your book, as 37 years have done to this poor thing. You can also do some background reading if you want to come into the library on Wednesday nights in Theosophical Movement, Volume 18. There's an article, Four Stages of Growth, and one of the articles pertains to the key. There's also a series of incredible articles written by a student. They're in a magazine, Theosophy 40 and 41, on the key in general. And gleaning from that and gleaning from years of reading this little textbook, we're reminded that after we begin to aspire in our search for truth, the second stage to the key to the philosophy is learning, fitting oneself by study and otherwise, sifting particulars, coordinating everything in the light of theosophical principles. This book appeals to those who are intrigued by the very deep mysteries of religions and who desire more explanation. Why does it so appear that religion, philosophy, and science has at its base particular oneness, a monistic drive, if you will? This is not a catechism, it's not a dogma, but rather the first third of the book deals with what is theosophy, what was the Theosophical Society, why is HPB a messenger? And that answers certain critics that arose in the late 1800s. The middle third of the book, from about page 83 on, actually 67 or so on, deals with the main points of the philosophy in a very straightforward way, so that no matter where else you're reading, if you're reading ISIS, if you're reading the SD, if you're preparing for an ocean class, and you really want to have a view, a concise kind of to-the-point review, the key is the place to turn. That center third of the book deals with so many things that we could discuss this morning. We could go through the three fundamentals. They're in here in a beautiful way that greatly supplements the proem of the SD. If we wanted to talk about the sevening of manifestation and how the cosmos, with a C, the manifest cosmos and the human being is very analogous, we could use the key for that. If we wanted to look at the scientific method and discuss cause and effect, we could use the key as a source for that. If we wanted to think about karma and reincarnation and the after-death states, we certainly could deal with the key. And the last third is kind of unique in the writings of HPB. The last third of the book is a very practical, hands-on response to all those pupils of HPB in the late 1800s, now, and in the future, who've come to the philosophy in an open-hearted, open-minded way and are wondering, what's the best help? What's the duty of a human being to take the philosophy and apply it and help offer it to another? And the dedication to the key speaks to the individual soul in that this book, unlike the earlier ones or unlike the voice, is dedicated to all of our pupils, every single one of any condition, who want to be able to be the better able to help and teach others. That this is a handbook, if you will. And that last third of the book has very, very pragmatic information about the true nature of social reform, the true nature of spiritual abnegation or asceticism, if you will, how it is to confront character and develop character and then use that to help others. She touches on public education. And so there's so much in the book that there's a triune key, if you will, three-pronged key to learning. To keep alive intuition on the individual level. To develop spiritual insight and tolerance and independent critical thinking and compassion. She writes that practical occultism is actually applied ethics in daily life. And that the port of entry to the philosophy is so, so important. It's crucial. So that by using analogy, by holding that concept, that timeless concept of the unity of life and the periodicity of a sevening of life, that we have the key to fit oneself by study and otherwise, to practice universal brotherhood and altruism, even though checked by karma. And it is the very practice that is the highest ideal of man's duty, a faith in spiritual intuition, a devotion to strict logic and reason, if you will. But the goal to be reached throughout all of life's experiences and what is due to humanity at large is equal rights and privileges, opportunities for all, that were never to deprive another of what she termed the fragrance of life. And so it, as we move through the pages of the key, from information about the society and how it was set up and how it was an association, through all those pages of information about the basic principles and teachings of the philosophy, or whether we go through the end of it as a pragmatic manual, if you will, for how to lead a good and a serviceable life. She reminds us that theosophy is never completely encompassed, that we cannot disseminate any particular idea fully, but that it is the student, it's the process of the guru parampara chain, if you will, that asking important questions, having the basis and truth of essential answers, is a process that we share, that goes on then, now, and forevermore for the good of each and all. There's a hand. Yes, sir.
Two things. In the talk, it was said that HPV was a messenger. And could we talk about the messenger from whom and to whom in particular? And then second, it was said something along the lines, cosmos with a C, not a K.
Okay. For the first point, there is the message and the source of the message and the messenger. HPB, through all of her writings, if you go through Isis, if you go through The Secret Doctrine, if you go to this wonderful little masterpiece, The Key, no matter which way you turn, she never, ever, ever says that this is original material. Not ever. In essence, what she says throughout her writings and to all of her students is that this is what she is to be a messenger of. That impacted in the very nature of the human being, timelessly, beyond, way back beyond history as we know it to be, that this message of ethics and science and philosophy, the nature of the human as spirit working through matter, as soul living in body, living in personality, those teachings are eternal. And she informs us that there is a source, there's a chain, if you will, of high adepts, masters, souls who once lived such as we, who have developed across time, and as a brotherhood have sustained these teachings and have safeguarded these teachings and have made the message available across time to all peoples, to all cultures, and that we see reflections of this here, there, and everywhere. So she always claimed to be a messenger from the masters, from this timeless chain of entities, of mind beings, and always turned people's focus to the message of the theosophical movement. What is the philosophy? How is this a oneness of religion, science, and philosophy? She even talked at one point of creating a bouquet and offering it as a collation publicly, universally to the public for the first time in the late 1800s. And your second question?
C versus K?
Oh, C versus K. Cosmos with a K pertains to a very ethereal, metaphysical, absolute source, if you will, that's often called the first fundamental, and that has no attributes yet contains, if we can even say that, presents the potentiality of all that we know as cosmos with the C. Cosmos with the C is what came emanating forth or reflecting forth or rolling forth, however we want to come to that concept, everything that we know of the universe and beyond that's manifest.
In my head where it's almost pathologic where in the last couple of years that I only trust original sources. Because it seems that any language by definition is an approximation already. So then if you go to a secondary source, it seems that it's an approximation of an approximation.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and you know, obviously I'm probably denying myself access to some wonderful works, but you know, even this key seems like it's an approximation of approximation. Can you comment on that?
You have to be careful which key you buy, to be perfectly honest. If you look in the front cover, the paperback yellow one was published in India. This one was published in 1930, and as I say, it's been used and abused. And it's like the Velveteen Rabbit. It's been much loved. This one, as the one from India, is a photographic reproduction of the actual original that HPB put together. And it was HPB that took her own sources, her own writing, and then developed this little textbook. It was published about a year after the SD in 1889 by the Allen Company originally. And then once ULT came into existence in the early 1900s, funds were raised, and this book was literally photographed and reprinted as the original. The reason I say be careful is that in the years following this original print, there are other copies. In 1891 or so, there was one published that has a glossary and an index in it that she did not put together. There are later copies where other folks have abridged this and added materials into it that she didn't write. So pathological, I don't know, that's a strong term. But to be critically aware that there's a difference between what the messenger actually put together in the late 1800s and what has come later. Can you think of a better way to say that?
No. These are the reason for the formation of the ULT was there were a handful of disaffected students because they started rewriting everything. After H. P. Blavatsky and William Q. Judge passed, things got rewritten. There were new publications. There was personalities involved. There were people who claimed to be successors who neither one of them ever left a successor. So actually most organizations, the majority of them, have gotten into what is known as pseudo-theosophy. It's not real. It's not the real thing. And interestingly, Gandhi himself spoke out in strong terms in 1907 against pseudo-theosophy and challenged one of the leaders of that group. But these are all original writings. She was an amanuensis, not so much in the case of the key, because that was a collation that she put together with other students. She had input into these questions, and she wanted to have a clear exposition. But she did do original writing, but she was also a channel, in a sense. Not what we think of as... But she could see literally into the astral, and that's why... There are so many sources, and there's no way that she physically got a hold of these sources, hundreds of sources.
So. And having said that, there were so many critics that arose, like editors of the National Reformer and whatnot, who really attacked ISIS and the SD as dogmatic or as revelation. And then when they started getting into where did that quote come from? Where did that footnote come from? And started delving into the older literature, they couldn't find any mistakes. All of the citations line up and are correct. This particular book is very interesting and very original in that when an editor or when a religious leader or when a spiritualist tried to twist something out of the other two books or try to critique something, she literally spoke to that particular point. So this is a very original text. But again, it's the original. It's not a latter day thing.
Two things real quick. In ISIS, it was witnessed that she was writing ISIS and came to a point she could not see in the astral a particular part of a particular sentence that she was quoting from, reading it from the astral. And this book happened to be in the Vatican at the time. And shortly after that, a friend of hers was traveling to Rome. She asked him to go to the Vatican, pull the book, and find out what it says. When he returned, he told her that the page had been smeared with some kind of liquid and it was not legible there either. You know? So there's that. But then also, we think that once a person in certain ways proves to him or herself that HPV's works are worthy of considering that they're probably original, and you get past that, it's not about taking every single thing on the page the word, but reading between the lines and behind the words, because the thought behind the word is so much more than what the word is. So that's why she emphasizes the development of intuition.
And over and over and over again, the reiteration is that this is not dogma, that this is not to be memorized. The invitation is to have the ruler, the judgment within, and intuitively and critically within, to think about what is being written and to judge for oneself what is true and what is not true, and what is applicable and what is not applicable.
Part of it was just touched on, but of course none of us like to think of ourselves as being mentally lazy or obtuse. But naturally that would be an obstruction. So how can we recognize those qualities within us, and how can we get rid of them?
How can we recognize when we're being mentally lazy or obtuse?
And get rid of them.
Some of us know because we have so few flashes of hard work that we know the difference. if we find ourselves tending to memorize or scanning to skim read, or if we find ourselves, the big joke in churchianity was the C&E crowd, the folks that would show up for Christmas and Easter and you'd never see them ever again. And that could probably apply to one who might only show up to public meetings here, and that's the end of it. But if we find ourselves never, ever taking a seed idea and using it during the course of a day, then we can begin to say, whoa, wait a minute here. Am I actually mentally engaged in comprehending what was just said, you know, the in between the words? It's one thing to parrot the words. It's another thing to know the nuance of meaning and how does that meaning come to life in daily, minute-by-minute living.
And all of the works by H.P. Blavatsky, William Q. Judge, and also Robert Crosby, they were very careful to put things together so that it couldn't be couldn't be codified into a religion. Mm-hmm. And that was, they were always aware of that. They did not want these, because you can memorize, there are many people that memorize the Bible chapter and verse, but they don't really go into the nuances, or they take everything very literally. And they wanted to avoid that, because that's being mentally lazy and obtuse in a way, we think.
We skipped over this hand. Yeah.
To gain some kind of grasp of all this, we have to consider the idea that we are perfectible, and that there are other beings that have come before us who have perfected themselves. We have Jesus, we have Buddha, there's numerous personalities throughout the ages who've exhibited this knowledge that we see printed on paper now. So if we understand that, we're looking for the truth. And our intuition, if we begin trusting it, we begin to see that it's the best guide we have. Is our intuition, and but our intuition knows what is true and what is not true. Mm. So all these things, there's a kernel of truth in everything. It's just that we have to take away the blinders from our eyes to see them.
And one who is mentally lazy or obtuse would be able to deafen themselves to that intuitive voice. Would be able to block it because they don't want to look at it, don't want to hear it really.
And we're given suggestions about setting aside a certain amount of time a day, at least a half hour, for meditation and contemplation and reading something that you can take a seed idea from and practice in your daily life. And also at the end of the day, to review the day and see where you succeeded, where you failed, where you could try better. So these are exercises. They are meant to counteract being mentally lazy. The mind should always be engaged. And so if we make that habit in the morning and in the evening, if we develop that habit, and we truly do practice what we read and think about, then we know, you know, we may not be great high spiritual beings, but at least we're on the right path. All the way in the back.
We just wanted to say that memorizing is part of not being mentally lazy. You have to put an effort in to remember what the teachings say, but then you have to ponder and question and come to understand it. But it was the ancient method. The Buddha gave talks, and the arhats would go and spread exactly what was said. So we think memorization is not to be criticized, it's to be used.
We just meant that there are those who can do that. They can memorize things, and they put the effort into that, but then that's the end of it.
Right. And if it's memorization for blind faith, that I'm going to memorize this particular set of words and then intone it periodically, or be able to spit out the correct words when I think it's politically correct, like the comment just was, that's not the end all. It's if there's a memorization, this is a key idea that I really want to try to consider. Memorize something, but then the next step is to look into the phrase, into the words, to see the nuances of meaning, and then to take that memorized phrase and maybe apply it to see if it works in different situations.
In the back there with the sweater, you.
Oh.
Yes.
My question is about the original sources, including the sources of HPB and the others, enlightened ones. It's been stated numerous times that for tens of thousands of years, this information has been stored, preserved, and kept well hidden and safe for the future of humanity. My question is, even in the oceans of in the oceans of the Atsvi, W.K. Judge insinuates that even prior to the destruction of the library in Alexandria, some of the important texts were taken away and preserved. So my question is, who's gonna, in light of the fact that I don't see many people studying these even available texts, like HPV and others, my question is, who's gonna win? Is the society gonna destroy itself first, or are we finally gonna start reading these hidden preserved texts, or are they just gonna remain hidden, you know, by the time we all kill ourselves?
Well, we have shared experiences on that, don't we? That we can look to in the recent past and then extrapolate what might happen in the future. We know, first of all, that there are libraries extant in the world, in this country, in Rome, in other places, where a tremendous amount of knowledge is stockpiled in underground. On the off chance that everything is destroyed, the information, the wisdom is still available. And we know that, you know, in some cases, information has been withdrawn and stockpiled officially by organizations that wish to keep it out of the public eye. But we have remarkable statements from the late 1800s that in cipher and glyph and caves underground, etc., there will come to light in the future information that is needed. And what came to mind also is that the dedication to the secret doctrine, written in 1888, is dedicated to all true theosophists in every country and of every race, for they called it forth, and for them it was recorded. But when we look back to this incarnation for this soul, in 1947, the Dead Sea Scrolls were found in a little clay pot underground in a desert scenario. The circumstances were correct, that the materials upon which they were recorded were kept in a dry, wonderful location so that it didn't fall apart. And just in time for the 1975 to 2000 cycle for the Theosophical Movement, these scrolls were translated and published and made available. And suddenly we've got very, very concise documentation that there were other gospels besides what appear in the New Testament. So if we connect the two things, one, we know there are stockpiles of wisdom or human knowledge here, there, and everywhere. Every major university has their ancient books, their antique book sections where you have trouble getting in unless you've got certain ID. Governments like the United States have things stockpiled. Churches like the Roman Church have things stockpiled. So we know that official sources exist. We've experienced within this incarnation accidental discoveries, and I make the quotes around accidental, karmic discoveries of unofficial stockpiles of information that have come to light. And we have the introduction to the SD for... They called it forth. The true theosophists in every country and of every race, universally soul, desiring truth and wisdom, set up enough karmic attraction, generation, however you want to think it, to have things once more rise to the surface, but only with true effort.
Yeah. Yes.
You keep over and over referring to HP being able to see into the astral. Can you tell me what you mean by that?
Okay.
As a student, I can only, in analogy, I've been told by students, high school kids, that if they study long and hard enough, some of them are able test day to sit with a test paper physically in front of them on their desks, close their eyes, and go through their notebooks, mentally turn pages in their notebooks until they get to the right page and they can see their notes, reading notes, class notes, reread it, and then answer the test question. In 40 years of an occupation, I heard that more than once from a variety of individuals. And I've always used that experience with a large number of kids, that if they can do that in a very mundane circumstance, there must be technique, substance, ability resident in human beings to do such a thing.
And if we think about the seven principles of man, that the one, besides the physical, the astral is where it is material as well. I mean, we may not be able to, the average person may not be able to see it or touch it, but it is material. The astral body is the design body. It's where our real senses are. And the astral is sevenfold. Everything is sevenfold. So a lot of it is the repository of, how should we say, not good stuff. But on the higher levels, it's much more spiritual. And it's something that if you have the eyes to see, one can see into it. We just, yes.
Well, one of the reasons that HPV came at this time, and Song Kha-pa, was to realize ethics and morality in the race. And she states that knowledge and ethics must be equal. And if one knowledge is existing and ethics aren't, like the world we live in now, there is decay, destruction, and death. That is just how it works. And you see back through history the same thing. Rome died from within. And we see that as we study history, that when the morals and the ethics do not match the knowledge, that we self-destruct.
Yes?
Regarding the previous question about the state of society or what will happen in the future, one of the remarkable things about the Key to Theosophy is at the very end, HPV makes a very specific prophecy or prediction about the condition of our society in the 21st century. I don't know if you have that last page available or can paraphrase.
I'm not sure.
It's the very last page.
It's
the last paragraph. It's the very last paragraph.
Okay.
There will be a heaven in the 21st century in comparison to what it is now.
It starts over here.
Yeah.
Okay. If you go to page 306 in the Key and 307, the last two pages, the Inquirer says, how does this bear on the future of the Theosophical Society? And this is the response by the Theosophist. If the present attempt in the form of our society succeeds better than its predecessors have done, then it will be in existence as an organized, living, and healthy body when the time comes for the effort of the 20th century. The general condition of men's minds and hearts will have improved and purified by the spread of its teachings, and as I have said, their prejudices and dogmatic illusions will have been, to some extent at least, removed. Not only so, but besides a large and accessible literature ready to men's hands, the next impulse will find a numerous and united body of people ready to welcome the new torchbearer of truth. He will find the minds of men prepared for his message, a language ready for him in which to clothe the new truths he brings, an organization awaiting his arrival, which will remove the merely mechanical, material obstacles and difficulties from his path. Think how much one to whom such an opportunity is given could accomplish. And then she goes on to talk about the previous 14 years with the TS. So, at the dawn of the 20th century, 1975, the question remains. The TS still was in existence, but had gone through myriad of changes. There was an accessible literature ready for folks to get to. And coming out of that time period, not only was that literature still in beloved book form, but it's now digital and online as well. And the next impulse will find a numerous and united body of people ready to welcome the new torchbearer. Certainly this student couldn't make a comment about witnesses on the scene and what came last. But isn't it interesting that the term united body of people, that the ULT picked up that word united. And again, if this were to continue, if every cycle, new generations of students follow that impulse to purify minds and hearts, to improve the ethical basis upon which they live, to envision a world in which public education offers all of humanity in every corner of the world a chance for free minds and free speech and the responsibility to face the results of their thoughts, thinking, and act. What else could be called forth?
Somebody had mentioned an earlier comment about the future of ULT. And we think that, well, in fact, it was just mentioned that there's another lodge in Mexico. So, we think that every now and then, you know, it may be a few years, but things, I mean, there's one in Haiti and Sudan. So it is spreading into around the world, but it's not numbers that we really need to look at, though. Although it is good that it's spreading, but if we have these mindsets, you know, putting all these wonderful ideas out in the astral, I mean, that in and of itself can help change the mindset of the world. And hopefully will, as it populates the astral, it will help to buffer the violent, materialistic ideas that are in there now as well. So we think it would be quality, not quantity.
Well, it's an interesting point. If we live by principles, and we hearken back to that first fundamental, is there any reality in the quantity, or is actually there a oneness of spirit, a oneness of mind that is expressing itself in the human condition through the human state in many, many different ways? So regardless of where people are, under what conditions, what they look like, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, they represent the effort of that oneness of mind and oneness of spirit to be manifest through all degrees of substance.
This gentleman's had his hand, but yes, over there.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, like, I don't know if we're getting close, but...
It's getting late,
is
but...
Is this a book that you read, like, front to cover, or...?
Yes.
Yeah, this is not set up. The SD is set up more on intuition, that you can follow a particular seed idea. This particular book is actually organized by subject matter. It's a very, very organized, concise way of looking up particular lines of thought for a particular seed idea. On page 233. Frequently in these rooms you'll hear, and even in the Declaration, the principles of theosophy and the fundamentals of theosophy, and sometimes you hear speakers interchange the two notions. On page 233, toward the back of the book, long after the fundamentals have been studied in this particular masterwork, there is a question, should theosophical principles be applied so that social cooperation may be promoted and the true efforts for social amelioration be carried on? What is our call to duty on behalf of the masses who may be struggling to be free, struggling to know, struggling perhaps just to have enough food to eat? And the theosophist responds, let me briefly remind you what these theosophical principles are. Universal unity and causation. Human solidarity, the law of karma, reincarnation. These are the four links of the golden chain which should bind humanity into one family, one universal brotherhood. And there we have the key within the key. Have a great week.
No? Okay. What am I doing?
This one.